Okay, let's get started then. First of all, welcome again for thank you for joining us today for today's webinar on opportunities for the 2021 and 2022 academic year with the Fulbright U.S. Scholar Program. My name is Michelle Belorci, and I'm an Outreach and Recruitment Specialist at IIE in Washington, D.C., and over the next hour, I will be sharing with you some information about the program, the mission, the history, as well as the opportunities available for 21 and 22, and we will have some time at the end for questions. Okay, so a little background about the program. As we gear up to celebrate our 75th anniversary next year, we are excited to continue to share opportunities in 160 countries around the world through Fulbright, and have opportunities for faculty, administrators, students, professionals, a range of professionals from artists to journalists, et cetera, to study, teach, and conduct research. And the mission of the Fulbright program is really to foster mutual understanding between people and advance knowledge across communities to ultimately improve lives around the world. We were established in 1946 by Congress, and this is the United States' flagship international educational and cultural exchange program. In addition to partner countries sponsoring opportunities around the world, the bulk of the program is funded by the U.S. Department of State and is administered by Institute of International Education, IIE. Diversity and inclusion is at the core of our outreach strategy and our recruitment strategy that informs our visits to campuses, the groups of students and faculty and administrators and professionals that we reach out to. This is something that's very important to the State Department, and so in terms of really ensuring that our program reflects the diversity of the United States population and our society, so we have no discrimination and opportunities are open to people regardless of their background, and that includes race and ethnicity, gender orientation, identity, disability, etc. So all are welcome to apply if they're eligible for the program. So many of you are here today and you already are convinced that that you're perhaps going to be applying this year or in the future. You're probably thinking, you know, this is the next step for me in my career. For those of you that perhaps are collecting information for the faculty that you work with and would like to enhance the information that you have, we'd like to share this slide to really indicate that Fulbright is a transformational experience. And this is something that we would like all of our Fulbrighters to have when they come back, is to really speak about the transformational experience that they've had. We want you to come back changed and with new networks, with new ideas for research and teaching, and to really serve as an ambassador for international exchange. There's a vibrant Fulbright network that's very supportive, and Fulbright is also one of the family-friendly opportunities out there that allows faculty and professionals and participants in our program to be able to bring their dependents with them. About 60% of our wards actually provide dependent support. So this is something that we'd like to point out. It's unique among our program, and we'd like to share that. So if you are thinking about ways to do your Fulbright, these are some great things to consider as you put your application in. In terms of the numbers, the Fulbright program offers about 8,000 awards annually, and specifically for U.S. scholars and administrators, we send 800 grantees around the world every year. And then, of course, we have the incoming visiting scholars, which are about 900 every year, and they're here primarily to conduct research. And then we send about 2,200 U.S. students around the world, as well as 4,000 students coming in. So this is very much a bilateral program. And then we also have language teaching assistants at our universities here that assist with language and culture. So altogether, there's been about 390,000 Fulbrighters since the inception of the program. Now, in terms of the distribution of awards, we do get a lot of questions you know, do I stand a better chance doing a research Fulbright or a teaching and research, or, you know, are there postdocs available? Those kind of questions. So the breakdown that we're showing you here is simply a reflection of the awards for the 2018-19 academic year. So this is how this reflects that. This is how people went on their grants. So it was about 40% of teaching and research, and then about 40% of either research or teaching. And I'd like to point out that we do have about 8% of our awards geared towards postdoctorate candidates. So those of you that perhaps work with graduate students who are looking for opportunities, this would be something that they could consider to add an international perspective to their research. So altogether, there is not one way to do a Fulbright, so to speak. It really depends on what the award is offering. Some awards, for example, are strictly research. Other awards are really looking to build capacity in that country and have an American scholar teaching in the classroom, building curriculum, and assisting with faculty training and development. So in terms of the eligibility for the U.S. Scholar Program, the baseline eligibility is U.S. citizenship. And then after that, it really depends on the award description and what that particular country is looking for. Keep in mind the awards catalog, and we'll be going through that a little bit later in the presentation. The awards catalog is made up of of descriptions of awards provided to us by those particular countries. So some may require a PhD or a terminal degree. Others are fine with a master's degree and a certain number of years of teaching experience or professional experience. And then we also have awards that are open to professionals, and that would require either a supplemental kind of portfolio to show your professional talents or certain years of experience in the field. For those of you that have held a Fulbright in the past and are interested in reapplying to the program for a scholar grant, we ask that there are 2 years in between the time that you've had your grant to the time that you're applying. And this only applies to U.S. scholar grants. It doesn't count. The two-year gap doesn't count if you had a specialist grant or if you had a Fulbright Hayes or a student program grant. It's only if you've had a scholar grant. All right, so as I mentioned, we do have a catalog of awards, and that catalog of awards features over 450 unique award opportunities. So that can be a little overwhelming when you can only apply for one award. So we encourage you to kind of navigate the catalog according to your career level and also what you're looking to do. So for example, as I mentioned, we have postdoc awards. We have awards that are designated specifically for early career academics. There are some mid-career opportunities. More on the kind of senior scholar side, we have the distinguished chair opportunities. And certainly, faculty that are emeriti or adjunct, as well as independent scholars, are welcome to apply. So it's important to filter those options accordingly to see where you would be eligible. We also have what's called the flex option. That's part of the award description. So if the flex option is available, it will be indicated in the award description. And that allows the researcher, the Fulbrighter, to carry out research over 2 academic years over multiple segments. So typically 2 to 3 segments are funded for that. So rather than doing a 6-month grant, you could do 3 trips of 2 months, for example. And then, of course, we have global opportunities, the Global Scholar Award, as well as regional awards that allow you to visit more than one country in a particular region. So as I mentioned, with the number of award offerings that we have, half the battle, I would say, is selecting the right award. So it's important to match up your expertise, your experience, perhaps any regional experience that you have or linguistic ability to what the award is seeking. And also to look out if there's any particular discipline preferred or subfields listed in the preferred list if it's an all disciplines award, for example. About half of the catalog is open, has awards that are open to all disciplines. So that means really, you know, a biologist, a musician, and a lawyer could all apply to that particular award. So if that particular award has specific fields that are of interest, making sure that you match up to that where possible. And then also to consider if your project is relevant to the host country. Will there be impact at the host institution? How will they benefit? This is very important to ensure that your topic is timely and relevant, because this is one of the key pieces that we review when we're assessing the applications. And then, of course, ensuring that you select the right award for your career level. Now, here's just a sample view of an award, and I'll be happy to navigate the catalog later on. But essentially, there are four main tabs to navigate. All of them have important information, so it's important that you click on more than just, you know, go beyond the awards details tab. So in the first, you'll see that there's grant activity, the length, you'll see the deadline as well, and the award requirements tab will indicate whether a letter of invitation is required by the award, so a host invitation letter. The stipend, including the benefits such as dependent benefits, any kind of relocation allowance, et cetera, all of that is outlined there as well. So kind of navigating that, and then of course in the top right corner, begin application process takes you to all of the application tips and resources as well as the application link. Now, in terms of what's required in the application, it's fairly straightforward, but we encourage that you begin as soon as possible so that you're not rushing at the end and trying to fill out the fields in the application right before the deadline. So, of course, what you tell your students, we also are telling you. Don't wait till the last minute. So, essentially, it's an online application form, and the key pieces are the project statement and I would say also the invitation letter if required, the CV and the other components such as the outline, the bibliography, any kind of portfolio that you submit, the project statement, all of these have page number limits and file size limits. For the CV or resume, 6 pages is what we ask for, or 8 pages if you're a distinguished chair applicant. So really kind of tailoring it down to what is most important for the review committee to know about you. What are the most relevant publications, the most recent and relevant teaching or research that you've done, that kind of thing. This year, we only require 2 letters of recommendation. So it's important that you consider carefully who you'll be reaching out to. It'll differ a little if you are strictly doing a teaching proposal. It'll differ if you're doing strictly a research proposal. And then, of course, a combination of that guidance we have online if you're doing a teaching plus research. If you're teaching, one letter should come from your home institution, for example. A language proficiency report may be required for some particular countries, let's say in Latin America or in Francophone Africa. In that case, you would register the language evaluator in the same way you would register your recommender. So then they would receive the online form and then evaluate your language skills accordingly. All right, so in terms of the project statement, we ask that you propose a project within 3 to 5 pages. So we understand that this is not a lot of space, and therefore we do not require in-text citations or any kind of attached bibliography. We do have the bibliography component to the application, and that's where you can put all of your sources and citations and even other works consulted or that are relevant to your project. So in 3 to 5 pages, we ask that you focus on what you plan to do, why you plan to do it, what the goals of the research are, and your methods. If you're teaching, what specific courses you plan to teach, why those specific courses, you know, perhaps that's what the host institution is looking for. So kind of discussing that, the dialogue or the communication that you've had with your host institution, and really highlighting what the impact will be on the host institution, as well as when you get back to the U.S., what the impact of your Fulbright will be, you know, the potential impact on your home institution, for you, your career professionally, on your personal kind of growth and all of that. So we're really looking to see how you could benefit from a Fulbright. And if you've gone to a particular country several times and you're proposing a Fulbright to that country, how will Fulbright be different? How will you use the platform of Fulbright to garner, you know, additional networks or broader kind of research goals or work with your colleagues? How will it differ? And then, of course, these other questions we've had, this is the change this year. We typically in the past asked that you address why Fulbright and why this country and your adaptability, speaking to that, in the project statement. But what we've done is we've separated those out. Those are now open, kind of short answers in the application form. So again, it's important not to wait until the last minute because these questions need to be filled out in the application form itself. All right, so moving on to affiliations and letters of invitation. So we do get quite a few questions about this, especially since about half of the awards do require an invitation letter, right? So for those of you that are looking to apply to a country where you don't have any particular contacts, this could perhaps be a little overwhelming, but we are here to help and there are several resources available. So in the one case where an award description states two potential or series of potential locations, that is then where you could be based. So we encourage you to start making contacts with those particular institutions, whether they're universities, et cetera. So on the left-hand side, we see the snippet. Two universities in Algeria are listed as the potential host universities. So you would look up perhaps somebody in that particular department where you hope to affiliate, write to them, write to a couple different colleagues, express that you're interested in an affiliation, that you'd be coming through the Fulbright program if you were selected for the grant, and giving a little background on your proposal, your project that you have in mind, as well as sending across your CV. It's up to them whether they decide to provide a letter, but at least you've initiated contact. Now, when an award does not have any institution listed, for example, on the right-hand side we see it says any accredited institution of higher education in Argentina. All right, great. So that means it's quite open, but then the determination of where you're being placed is kind of left on the scholar. So when a host is not identified, there are several resources, and we'd like to kind of assist you with that. The first thing is take a look at any particular host suggested in the award description or any kind of resources that are listed. The second one would be to look at our Fulbright Scholar Directory. The directory goes back 10 years and includes not only the U.S. scholars who went to Argentina, for example, but all of the scholars from Argentina that came to the U.S. And it would list their project, their affiliation, where they're from, what their home institution is in that country, and that way you could start perhaps reaching out that way. So the Fulbright Scholar Directory is a great resource. If you're not able to find anybody in a particular country from your discipline that could assist you, perhaps you could reach out to your international office. Now, not all campuses have this, and not all have a vibrant international community. If that's not available, please do contact the staff at IIE. We are happy to help. All of our information is located in the award description. So if you're interested in the award to Argentina, for example, you would contact me, and I could then work with my colleagues in Argentina to get some suggestions for you. Right, so this is where you would see, if we're looking at the award description, the award requirements tab would indicate whether the invitation is required or not. Now, once you get the invitation letter, keep in mind it is a non-binding invitation. It's an expression of interest from the host. They might be providing this to everybody who reaches out who has an interesting project. So it's not binding, and it doesn't mean that you've been accepted to the program. Ideally, it should come from the person you hope to collaborate with, unless, of course, there's a different protocol listed in the award requirements tab. Some partner awards have a designated person listed there, their contact, their name, et cetera, and they're the ones who provide the invitation letter. They may not be the one who you'll be collaborating with. But ideally, if you can, it would be from the person you hope to collaborate with. It would be on letterhead, and it would explain what you are going to be doing there during the specific timeline, what the impact will be, and also kind of conveying that enthusiasm and excitement for hosting you. So definitely going beyond the boilerplate standard, sentence or two is certainly helpful. The more information and detail that's provided in the invitation letter, the better it'll be. Okay, so now moving on to kind of the overview of the kind of competition and application cycle. We are in the middle of the competition. The deadline is September 15. Again, these are for opportunities in 2021, 2022, so fall of 21 typically and spring of 2022. Once the deadline reaches, we have September 15. After that, we conduct the technical review. And in October and November, we have the U.S. peer review. That's consisting of discipline peer committees. After that, any recommended applications are then forwarded to the final review in country and also to the J. William Fulbright Foreign Scholarship Board, known to us as the FFSB. Final decisions are then made between January and April, and notifications are sent out during that time. Okay, and I just want to switch gears for any of you that are on that are administrators. We do have some exciting administrator seminars available in these particular countries. And these are two-week opportunities, typically, to immerse yourself, if you're an international education administrator, in that particular country's higher education system. So the itinerary includes typically three visits across the country, meeting with leadership at universities, colleges, different higher education institutions, and really having dialogues about ways that they that country can kind of tie up with the institutions in the United States. These are strictly just short-term engagements, so a project proposal is not required. The application looks a little different, and more importantly, the deadlines are throughout the year. So the September 15 deadline does not hold for these, so it's important to take a look on our website for the individual deadlines and also the dates of these trips. And you can get more information by reaching out to IEA at IIE.org. In addition to that, we have some opportunities for institutions. We have the Scholar in Residence program, where you can host a Fulbright, incoming Fulbright scholar in the U.S. to teach at your university or college. We have the Outreach Lecturing Fund, which is kind of shorter visits of those Fulbright visiting scholars, and they're able to come to your campus. And then, of course, I hinted earlier at the Foreign Language Teaching Assistant program, the FLTA, where native speakers come to your institution to teach their language and share about their culture. So the contact information for all of these programs is listed here, and we're happy to send out more information your way. Additional programs that fall into kind of this wider Fulbright umbrella, not all of them are administered by IIE, but there are other cooperating agencies that administer these programs, and we've provided the contacts here. But I would like to point out the Arctic Initiative, which is open this year. It's an exciting opportunity for scholars in the U.S. and other countries that are Arctic Circle member, Arctic Council member countries, to participate in research that would affect policy making, and this is more of a long-term engagement, although the trips in between are shorter. So more information can be found online, and you can reach out to arctic at IIE.org. And I'd like to leave you with our contact information before we go to the question page. You can reach out to us at scholars@iie.org. I encourage you, if you haven't started your application already, to get started on the application so you can receive our application tips and information about upcoming webinars and virtual advising sessions. You can also sign up to get more information at MyFulbright, which is CIES2.org. And, of course, I encourage you to follow us on social media, read about interesting stories that Fulbrighters are engaged in terms of research and teaching all around the world, and the impact of their grants. So I'd like to open it up now to questions, and I've got my colleague Sarah Kosser on the line to help us navigate all the questions. So Sarah, what do we have first?
Great questions coming in. Thank you so much again for that presentation, Michelle. The first question we have is, does someone have to be currently employed at an institution in order to apply for the scholar program?
Great question. And the answer is no. So there are some awards that might require an institutional affiliation, but the majority of awards, the vast majority of awards, are open to independent scholars, independent researchers, professionals that are not affiliated with a particular institution. So that's absolutely fine. You're welcome to apply, even also if you're retired and not affiliated with an institution. So it's important to take a look at the award description because it really depends on what they're looking for there.
Perfect. The next question we have is, if someone is a U.S. citizen but they're currently living and working outside the U.S., can they still apply through the scholar program?
Sure, that's a great question. So we do have an eligibility kind of criteria, and I'm happy to kind of point that out on our website. But as long as you meet the residency requirements, which require that in the previous 6 years, no more than 5 years have been spent abroad, then you would be eligible.
Perfect. We are getting a few questions about the recording and access to the PowerPoint, so I'd like just to make a little announcement that this session is being recorded, and usually within 3 to 5 business days, we do load both the PDF version of the slides and the recording on our website. So please keep an eye out for that, but hopefully that answers all the questions coming in. The next question for you, Michelle, is, does the flex option apply to all the award categories or only some? And I think what they mean here is between research, teaching, the combination, so on and so forth.
Right, that's a great question. So typically in the past, it's only been available for research projects, but I have seen this year that some countries allow teaching as well, and I think that would really only be if the first of all, if the host institution agrees to that, and second of all, if the teaching took place more in kind of block seminars or perhaps just building curriculum and training faculty. So it might not necessarily be the standard category of teaching a semester-long course. But again, it's important to check the award description and also confirm with the host if they're on board with that.
Okay. The next question I actually really like, if someone is hoping to do research in more than one city within just one country, should they get more than one invitation letter or an invitation for each area within that country? And how do the selection committees feel about having more than one host institution?
Okay. So, and you had said that the multiple institutions within a country, is that what the question was?
It looks like it's all within one country, yeah.
Okay. So typically, that's a good question. And again, it's really going to depend on the award. If you are, if you have invitation letters from more than one potential host and you are open to kind of going wherever you think that that particular country would want to place you based on their needs or based on their priorities, then I would indicate that you have invitations from others, but I think it's important to generally just provide the one invitation letter, and that would be the institution that you hope to affiliate with. That would be your primary choice. But it is very, very useful and helpful if you indicate in the project statement that you do have invitations and interest from institution B, C, and D as well, for example. I know for some countries, like India, for example, they're fine with seeing a couple of invitation letters and then deciding where you would be the best fit. But again, it's important to speak primarily to and orient your project statement primarily to one host institution because you will be primarily affiliated with one institution.
Perfect. Thanks so much, Michelle. We do have a question of if someone is earning their PhD May of 2021, when is the earliest that they can apply?
Yeah, again, you're going to hear this a lot from me, so apologies if it sounds a little redundant. It really depends on the particular award and what their requirements are. So in general, the program eligibility requirements you can find here, and that states that in order to be eligible for the program, unless otherwise specified, that you have your PhD by February 1st of the year following the So for example, I can point it out right here, February 1st of the year following the application deadline. Otherwise, there are some awards, for example, I can think of the postdoc awards to Australia that allow you to apply this year, for example, because the awards only begin in spring of 2022, January, February of 2022, and as long as your degree is completed by the grant start date, you're fine.
Okay. That answers that. The next question is, can you go a little bit more into detail on the selection process and who typically makes up a selection panel for this one interested applicant?
Sure. So I'm here, I've come to the timeline tab under the kind of overview section, and there's two main rounds of review. So the peer reviews that take place typically in Washington, D.C. are made up of discipline committees. And those are typically people who are in your field, faculty, researchers, et cetera, who reviewed the application for the merit of the project, et cetera. Those applications are then, the recommended applications are then sent to the particular countries of application, and the final decision is made in country by the committee in that particular country. And those are typically binational committees. And they're typically also interdisciplinary. So again, that's a good point I forgot to bring up. The project statement should be accessible not only to the specialist, but to the layperson as well.
Perfect. Thanks so much. We are getting a few questions about application number, success rate, how competitive Award A versus Award B might be. Can you just highlight our standing on giving out those numbers?
Sure. So unfortunately, we're not able to share any kind of application statistics. But what I would say for those of you that are concerned about, you know, you're only allowed to apply for one award and you'd like to be the most competitive where possible, take a look at the review criteria that we have online. And as I mentioned earlier, it's really important to ensure that your profile and project match up very well to the award description, and that the host institution, if the invitation is required or preferred, even if it's optional, I would also encourage you to get an invitation, that the host institution will benefit from you being there in terms of your research, your teaching, et cetera, and that there's a clear connection between what you hope to do and that particular country. You know, you wouldn't want that your project statement looks like you could just substitute Brazil for Germany and it would read the same. You really want to ensure that you've tailored this project statement directly to the project, not only in that particular country, but with those colleagues at that host and in that location. So it should really make sense that, yes, this person really needs this award. They need a Fulbright to go and do this. It makes sense. And you really want to also kind of have that wow factor. What is new? What is interesting about your project? Again, those are the things to consider as you put your application together.
Perfect. Thank you so much. The next question that we have, is, if you don't mind just taking a second to address what's currently going on with COVID-19, and if you could just show the section of our website for them to find more information about that, I think that would be really great.
Sure. So we do have some guidance here on COVID, and I just want to kind of underscore the fact that, you know, for better or for worse, the awards that we're recruiting for are in 2021 and 2022. So this is where you can find out our information, and we'll update that regularly. But again, keep in mind we're looking out for opportunities in 2021 and 2022. Of course, nobody really can predict the future, and we don't really, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty with this pandemic, but we don't anticipate any disruptions at this point. And if we do, of course, we would keep everyone updated. If grant dates need to change, should you be accepted, they could be potentially change within that particular academic year. But beyond that, I don't really have any further guidance. If you are able to and you feel kind of a little more reassured in applying for a grant during the spring 2022 semester, I would encourage you that if that's possible. And I can actually show you, if we go to the catalog, this will kind of segue into what I was hoping to show. If we click on, you'll see there's 453 awards. If I just click on this first award here, I can see what they're looking for. On the right side, I can see the activity here, what's allowed, whether a degree is required or not, the terminal degree, what kind of profile they're looking for. And I can also see the grant start dates. So here it says October 2021 or mid-February 2022. So potentially, you could apply this year for a grant that would be nearly a year and a half out. So that would be something to consider as you look at the grant start dates and also consider what your schedule and your availability would be.
Perfect. The next question we have, I think it's just from your experience being on the review panels, but what is the main reason that you have seen for why an application might be unsuccessful?
Sure, that's a great question. I would say, kind of think about how, if you're a faculty member and you read assignments from your students, if you're, kind of scratching your head at the end of reading the assignment and you're a little confused and some questions haven't been answered and there's gaps in information, I think those are the biggest reasons why applications don't get further along in the process is because they present an incomplete picture or the feasibility and the suitability of the project don't really come across clearly, or they're not outlined in a way that appears that this is going to be a suitable presentation project for this particular host country or host institution. And perhaps it's overly ambitious. Instead of 3 months, the project looks like it needs 12 months, but the award is only for 3 months. So those kind of things. You really want to ensure that you match up what you hope to do with that particular grant time allotted. So for example, this award that I have open, this is a 4-month or 5-month award. So if you're proposing something that would require a little more, maybe 6 months or 8 months, be sure to only highlight in your project proposal what you'll be doing in those 4 to 5 months and talk about that in your project statement, for example. So those are some of the key reasons, I think, is that either incomplete information, not suitable or feasible, or I would say the third point would be not exciting or there's nothing new, so what, right? So you really want it. This is a competition. We're looking for stellar applications, and we really hope to see some exciting projects. Again, keeping in mind the mission of the program is connecting people, promoting mutual understanding, and having our Fulbrighters serve as kind of cultural ambassadors. So that, I would say, are the biggest reasons, Sarah.
Perfect. Thank you so much. If you don't mind, I'm going to answer two real quick and then segue back to you. We have one question about the Scholar in Residence program and if it will be available for 2021-2022. The program is currently on a delay. However, keep your eye open in January of 2021 for more information about the next cycle for FIR, and we look forward to your interest there. And if anyone does have questions, please email fir@iie.org. The next question is about more information regarding the IEA seminars. And I think what Michelle talked about was a very broad overview. We do have upcoming specific webinars on the IEAs that I encourage you to register for as well. But as Michelle said, they are two-week seminars where you go in a cohort to another country where you're looking and comparing their higher education system to the U.S. You may present on your institutions and what you're doing, but a lot of it is very collaborative. I hope that does answer that question, but I really implore you to email iea@iie.org. Sorry about that, Michelle. I thought I would just quickly touch that.
Sure.
The next question is, we're getting a few extra questions about flex options. What is the, how many visits can they do? What are the length minimums within that? And I think still people are questioning whether or not they can do teaching within that option.
Sure. So I wanted to bring up the information we have online and then also show you how that works in the award description, because that's really where you're going to want to check for the parameters for Flex. So again, looking at this award to Albania, it says the Flex option is available. Let me just point that out here. So the Flex option is available, and it has the parameters listed here. So the minimum length of the grant is 4 months, and the maximum is 6 months. Any grant segment should be at least 1 month minimum, maximum of 3. And it says Flex awards are offered for teaching and research, or research grants. So again, it's important to have buy-in from the host institution. The Flex option might be available for all of these grant activities, but the host institution might not agree to a teaching Flex. So as I mentioned, typically in the past, they have only been really for research projects, but again, it's important to kind of keep that line of communication open with the host institution. Even if the award is optional, again, you'd like to ensure that your project will be successful, and again, as I mentioned, the suitability and the feasibility are two big pieces that we're looking for when we review applications. So even if the optional invitation is, you know, if it's an optional invitation, we would hope that you contact the host institution to see if they would be amenable to Flex.
Perfect. While you're in here, is there a possibility to discuss the distinguished chair positions and how they differ from other teaching research awards, other than more?
Yes, absolutely. So I'd like to point out here on the left-hand side we have the filters. So in order to search for distinguished chair of awards, which are typically available for associate professors and above, we would just click here. And this just keeps it, I still am searching all around the world, but I have the 45 distinguished chair awards listed here, and I can see exactly the titles, and also on the right-hand side, what particular grant activity. So, for example, Australia has several distinguished chair awards. Brazil has a good offering. The Czech Republic, for example, Finland. So it's important, again, each chair award may or may not have the same requirements within that particular country, especially if they are partnered with a particular institution. Poland has several, Sweden, the UK, etc. So if we click on one, for example, this one's a new one in neuroscience to Brazil. The grant activity simply states teach graduate courses and develop collaborative research with faculty. It's a teaching and research grant for 4 months, and more of the profile can be found here. 10 years of experience after the PhD. So that is the particular requirement for that award.
Perfect. I'm going to keep asking questions as they pertain to the catalog of awards right now. And there are so many questions coming in. We're very excited about your eagerness. If we don't get to every question today, please email us at outreach@iie.org. We'll make sure to answer them. But I'm going to keep going and seeing how far we can get. The next question is, can you dive in a little bit more of what it means by mid-career, and how do we define that?
Sure. So I think that would open up the question to how we also define early career, et cetera. So I'm going to take out, you'll notice here in the candidate profile section on the left-hand side, we say academics of all career levels, including early career, and then we have those that are open to academics except early career. So first of all, early career for us in Fulbright essentially means those of you that have completed your PhD within the last 5 years. So you have the terminal degree, the PhD or terminal degree, and it's been 5 years or less. Right, so you would be able to search for not only postdoc opportunities, but also the academic, including early career level opportunities. Mid-career is anything after those 5 years. So typically, and again, I don't want to say it's at the associate level or at the assistant level or anything like that. I would say assistant level if you pass those 5 years. And again, the distinguished chair opportunities are typically for the associate level or full professor level applicants who have also a distinguished record of teaching and research.
Perfect. Thank you so much. The next question we have is if someone is applying for a teaching award, what kind of projects would they assume would be part of that teaching? Do you mind elaborating a bit?
Sure, sure. So let's take a look at, I'm just going to do another search here for early career opportunities, all levels actually. And if I click on grant activity here, we can just narrow it down to the teaching awards right away. So again, it's going to vary. And let's see. So in Algeria, let's say if we take the TEFL Applied Linguistics, this one specifically states, and this is a teaching award, this one specifically states teach at the undergrad or graduate level, teaching either TEFL or Applied Linguistics, and the classes, you know, 60 to 150 students, 6 to 10 hours per week. I mean, some of these are very detailed, almost in a way like a job description. But again, that is what Algeria is looking for. So really building capacity and having the scholar work with the particular university to develop appropriate syllabi or to use the syllabi that you have already in hand and kind of tailor it for the students there. So again, the number of classes, the length of classes, and the frequency of the classes per week are typically, if they're outlined, you know, in this award description, it would be right up top. Others might say, okay, teach and research or teach undergraduate or graduate level courses. It's then up to the applicant to determine is that one course plus faculty development and curriculum kind of workshops and things like that for faculty, or is that two courses and none of those other activities? So it can be a combination of teaching plus teaching related activities.
Great, thanks so much. The next question we have is about if you can comment on support for dependents. It's not, obviously, in your first slide you said about 60% do offer dependent support. Do you mind just touching on what that could look like and how,
sure,
where one would get that?
Sure. So actually in this award to Algeria, we see that there are allowances for dependents. We also see a breakdown. Stipend varies if you're an assistant professor or below, or an associate professor and above. We see here the travel and relocation allowance is outlined, and then it looks like dependent tuition allowance for K through 12 enrollment at one of the international schools, and kind of other benefits in terms of internet fees or medical checks for residency cards, things like that. So the dependent tuition allowance benefits are typically outlined here in the stipend and benefits tab. And oftentimes it's based on reimbursement.
Great.
And I'd also like to point out, Sarah, before we move on to the next question, I didn't get to,
yeah,
to highlight this, office hours that we have available. So for those of you that are perusing the catalog and rather than emailing us back and forth, you just kind of like to join in an office hour for that particular country or region, if you click on join an office hour, it'll take you to, I'm going to open that. It'll take you to our calendar, our schedule of office hours. And so typically every Monday is awards to Europe and Eurasia, Tuesday, South and Central Asia and Western Hemisphere, et cetera. And you can either join in right at that moment. So if it happens to be that particular time, these are all Eastern Standard Time. So you could join in right at that time. And otherwise, you could register and get the email notification.
Perfect. The next question that we have, can you dive in? We have a few artists on the line, but they'd like to know from their perspective how competitive they are and what aspects will be asked from them and how it differs from some of these other awards.
Sure. So, of course, we understand that most of the catalog is viewed through the lens of, a faculty member applying, and so kind of the breakdown of teaching and research and all of that. But I do want to point out that we have added the professional project. So that is something that is now available, searchable in the catalog. So if you are interested in doing something that doesn't pertain to the traditional academic research or teaching, but it relates certainly to the profession you're in, and you have a requirement of visiting a particular country to carry out some research, whether it's working with an NGO or a think tank or a theater or a conservatory, etc. You can click on that here, and I'm going to actually click on professionals, and you can see the options. So I would say you would be most competitive when you search for an award that A is open to professional projects and B is open to professional applicants. You can also remove the activity and just search for professionals. You might just find a teaching award available as well, but certainly that would be the way to start. And then secondly, when you do find an award that's interested in artists, so for example, we have this award to Austria. If I click here, this is an artist in residence award, and a terminal degree is not required. There are up to 3 grants, and they're looking for people in contemporary media and all kinds of specializations listed below right here. And so dance, theater, media art, et cetera, you can find all that information, street art, photography, digital culture. And so this would be, I encourage artists and professionals who don't really fit the academic mold to look at awards where it really speaks to you and where there's that synergy of what they're looking for and what you hope to do, where there's a better fit. And then the next step would be to gauge interest by contacting that particular institution. So for example, here again it says an invitation is optional, but I always encourage applicants, when it's possible, when it's allowed, seek out an invitation letter, and that's a good way to gauge interest, because again, since you can only apply for one award, when you start reaching out for different contacts to seek affiliations, it really helps to kind of shop around and go with the award, go with the institution that is most excited about hosting you and really would, you would add value and they would add value to what you're doing. And then, of course, a nicer, more detailed, enthusiastic invitation letter would come about from that.
Great. Thanks so much. For postdoc awards, are people with terminal degrees, such as an MFA, eligible for postdocs or not?
So I would say the postdocs that are titled, that have postdoctoral award in the title, are those more kind of traditional postdoctoral awards where you would need, this is post-PhD. But if you do, if you'd like to click on postdocs to see what we have, the new thing this year is that there have been several awards that have opened up to postdoc applicants that are not necessarily postdoc awards, so if that makes sense. So for example, here, if I click on the award to Australia at Deakin University, this is a traditional postdoc award. A PhD is required, a terminal degree is required, and you will have a bit of mentoring built in because you are a postdoc candidate, right? You're an applicant, and eventually if you become a grantee to Deakin University, you are their postdoc Fulbrighter. Now that differs from an award that's open to all disciplines, for example, Algeria. This is an all disciplines award. There's nothing postdoc about it, except it does mention that it's open to postdoc candidates, right? So those that have completed a postdoc, a PhD in the last 5 years. So it's also open to those that don't have a PhD or terminal degree. So in other words, for this particular award, you're competing with a range of scholars. With the postdoctoral awards that have postdoc in the title, you're only competing with people who've completed a PhD within the last 5 years.
Great. Thank you so much. I'm going to segue now to a few questions about the language proficiency. Can you navigate to the language proficiency evaluation page on our website just so people know how to get to that? And then
sure.
Two questions. The first is, how would someone self-evaluate based on the requirements level for the host country? And then the second question is, how do you go about proving that you can write in that language? And I think that would lead to the second part of the evaluation survey.
Sure. So there are two parts to the language proficiency evaluation. And whether or not both are required or either of them are required would be outlined in the award description. So let me select an award where I know that there's a requirement. So for example, let's see. Let's click on this. If we click on the award requirements, we see for Mexico, the language proficiency is required at the intermediate level, so Spanish intermediate level. And it says that applicants must register a qualified language evaluator. Okay. All right. So, and that the language of Spanish must be commensurate with the requirements of the project. Fine. So we go back here, and the self-evaluation is one where you're in the application form and you fill it out. Okay. So that's fine. You fill out judging your own, kind of evaluating your own abilities. The second one is the external evaluation. That's what we mean by required. Okay, so that's where you would register your somebody at a university or college who teaches that language. So they don't have to be from your institution if you don't have that particular language taught on campus. As long as the person is a language instructor, typically based at an institution of higher education, we're fine with that. Now, you would register their name in the application form. They would then receive the electronic evaluation form and, you know, evaluate you in the way that you can. Nowadays, of course, with, you know, everyone staying at home, that might be through a phone call or video chat or what have you, so that they could do it in real time and that you could be evaluated kind of based on the fluidity that you have, the fluency rather, that you have in answering questions and replying in written format.
Great, thanks so much. The next set of questions I have, and I'm making sure I'm aware of the time, are in regards to teaching. How specific of the teaching agreement should be in the application and letter of invitation?
Well, of course, the more information you have, the better. But if the communication is a little challenging or not very forthcoming from the institution, or they actually say, hey, we're fine with whatever you want to do, which can be helpful or not in giving you kind of carte blanche, but as much information as you can put in there, and I think it's really important to speak to the needs of the institution, identifying the gaps and where you can fill those gaps. So if they haven't had somebody teach an applied linguistics course and that's your field of specialty, that would be great to offer. If they're looking to build a program and incorporate, you know, kind of new courses that you have an expertise in, excellent. So I would say really just where can you add value as a Fulbrighter, and if you're not able to get feedback from the host institution or a letter invitation is not required and you don't have one, any kind of email communication that you've had with the institution, if at all, can be reflected in the project statement, and just a perusal of their course offerings online, what kind of courses and what direction the department is in, identifying those areas of interest or the areas where you feel you could add value, that's what you would want to put in your proposal and have syllabi that reflect that accordingly.
Perfect. Going along with what you just mentioned, if it's a combination of teaching and research, how much should time and space in their project statement should be used to address each? Do you have kind of a guideline for that?
Sure, that's a great question. So unless it's outlined in the award description, whether it's a 50-50 or what the ratio is for teaching and research, it's really going to depend on what your proposal is all about. So for example, this award to South Africa offers research, teaching, or a combination. So it looks like the applicant would need to determine that ratio either in conjunction with the host institution or, you know, on their own. So if you're doing a 60-40, so 60% research and 40% teaching, then of course we'd want to see a little more of the project proposal focusing on research. Nepal, for example, has a teaching research award that requires 80% teaching and 20% of the time can be devoted to research. So certainly in that proposal, we would want to see that ratio kind of breakdown of discussion of teaching and then just a little bit of, you know, discussion on research. So I think we're at time. Do we have one last question perhaps that we can take?
Yeah, actually, I know there's a lot of other questions. Please, again, email me at outreach@IIE. We'll pass along to each other and make sure you do get your question answered. But the last one I think is very applicable is, can you address the process for adjunct teachers? Are they less likely to receive grants than standing faculty?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that's something that adjuncts have to really worry about. I think what everyone who puts a proposal together should consider is discussing the impact piece. So what can you bring to that host institution, to that host country, and what are you going to take back with you? You know, will you add a kind of more internationalized dimension to your teaching? Will you have, you know, continue collaborations with your hosts, and, you know, whether it's publications or an MOU or inviting that person, that collaborator, over as a Fulbright visiting scholar? We really want to know, what are you going to make of your Fulbright? So it doesn't really depend so much on whether you're a full-time faculty, you're an independent researcher, you're retired, you're an adjunct, or whether you're at a community college or at an R1. We're really looking to see, where can you have the most impact and make the difference, and really, where can you add value to this particular academic community abroad?
Perfect. Thank you so much, Michelle. This has been helpful. I know we didn't get to everyone's questions. There were just so many in here, and they're still coming in. But again, please, again, just email us at outreach@iie.org, and we'll make sure to take care of you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. And again, I'm happy to have you join an office hour. Again, the times are all in Eastern. I think we need to update that on our website, but these are all times in Eastern Standard Time, and we're happy to answer questions live in the webinar over email, or you can give us a call. All of our contact information is listed in the awards catalog.
Perfect. Thank you again for your time today, Michelle.
Thank you, everyone, for joining. I'm happy you all could make it. And again, this has been archived. This will be archived in a few days on our website. So feel free to listen in again if we didn't get to everything in a pace that could be digestible. I know it's a lot of information, but we're happy to help, and we wish you all the best on your application. Bye-bye.